Look, it's hard being the pop culture friend. You're the one who knows exactly what new show is the most watched show on Netflix right now, or you're on top of the film festival calendar. Whether you are that friend or you desperately need a friend like that, allow Commotion to enter your group chat. It's a podcast hosted by me, Alamine Abdul-Mahmoud, where I talk to people about the arts and entertainment stories that you need to know, and we share all the recommendations of what you should be reading or watching or listening to. Find Commotion wherever you get your podcasts.
After nearly 2 years of warnings, Gaza is now facing the most dire consequences of food shortages.
Have you ever held a four-year-old child so thin that he or she weighs the same as a one-year-old?
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Today, starvation in Gaza is real. Also on the program, the debate over anti-Semitism.
There is a very, very deep divide among American Jews, particularly along generational lines.
Plus, a new fuel, angles to replace gasoline.
They're not just a future hope, they're a present solution.
And on the Thai-Cambodian border, there have been years of tensions.
Especially near areas with ancient temples that both sides claim. And in recent months, the situation has intensified until both sides assembled their armies.
Those stories and more today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for tuning in. We begin in Gaza, where the number of people dying from hunger is rising by the day. Since Saturday, at least 43 people have died, according to health officials in Gaza. In the past few months, Israel has set up its own aid delivery system with help from the U.S.
But Palestinians in Gaza, aid groups and international NGOs say the aid is insufficient and people are starving. The World's Shirin Jafari reports.
For the past 4 months, Ahmed Abu Amr has been making the same long trek to aid distribution points in Gaza.
Every day I try to get a little food or a little water, but I'm not taking anything yet.
Amr's journey starts at midnight. He walks from northern Gaza, where he lives with his family, to the south. He walks for hours, he tells me, then camps at the aid site, along with hundreds of other people desperate for food. They wait, sometimes 8 to 9 hours, for sacks of flour to be distributed.
We cannot get this because shooting or bombing us. We run again and back. My place.
It's the same scenario every time, Amr says. As soon as they start handing out food, guards start shooting in their direction and they have to run. He returns to his family empty-handed.
Yesterday, 30 people killed. In front of my eyes, I was very tired.
He told me that yesterday, and in the month we've been speaking, exhaustion and desperation has only grown. He says he hasn't eaten in days. He no longer remembers what fruit tastes like. Chicken, eggs, cheese. Those are distant memories for him at this point. The hunger in Gaza is leaving its mark on the tiny bodies of babies. A journalist shared this video of baby Mohammed. He whimpers while lying on a hospital bed, his skin clinging tightly to his bones. His eyes seem enormous for his hollow face. He's one of many babies fighting for survival these days. Dr. Joanne Perry is with Doctors Without Borders. She's currently in northern Gaza. She says doctors started to see malnourished children about 6 months ago when Israel completely stopped the flow of aid. But now, she says, roughly 10% of children under 5 are malnourished. She's seeing the same percentage of malnourished pregnant and breastfeeding mothers.
This is an incredible amount of people. If you consider the population of Gaza, it's just over 2 million.
Doctors prescribe these children with nutritional supplements, but in many cases, they're not enough.
It's difficult for mothers to see their children hungry and asking for more food. And we know for a fact that mothers are sharing this food with their other children because their children are also hungry.
As a result, the number of children dying is on the rise. Rachel Cummings is with Save the Children in Gaza.
You know, I've seen many phases of this emergency and this war, but what we're seeing now is like nothing I've ever seen before.
Cummings says right now, Save the Children has nutrition and medical supplies for about 5 to 6 weeks. But as the numbers of those in need grows, so does the need for more supplies.
We have supplies, medical supplies, hygiene kit, all waiting to come in. But as yet, we haven't had clearance for those supplies to enter Gaza.
More people, especially children, will die, she says, if aid doesn't get through. Alex DeWall heads the World Peace Foundation at Tufts University. He's an expert on famine and mass starvation. He says he's seen starvation before in places like Somalia, Ethiopia, and Sudan.
What we have not seen is this happening at a place and in a manner where just a few miles away there are international aid agencies with the resources, with the plan, actually ameliorating this situation.
The Gaza Humanitarian Foundation has come under scrutiny for the way it operates. At least 1,000 people have been killed while trying to get aid, according to the Gaza Health Ministry. Alex DeWall says this system of aid delivery is not only dangerous, it's humiliating and dehumanizing.
And one thing actually I would say to all those commentators who are trying to dice and slice this and say, do we know this? Do we know that? Have you ever held a four-year-old child who is so thin that he or she weighs the same as a one-year-old?
This week in Tel Aviv, Israelis marched in protest of the conditions in Gaza. They held up posters of starving children and carried sacks of flour on their shoulders. One sign read, "Standing together against starvation." More than 100 aid organizations and rights groups have called on Israel to lift the restrictions. Israel says it has to control aid because Hamas steals it and uses the money to finance its military activities. Alex DeWall again.
This always happens in every war zone. There is no aid operation that is 100% foolproof. But the idea that one would starve an entire population, you know, more than a million children, because of some as yet unverified incidents, I think speaks to an intent that is not a humanitarian intent.
What's needed to end the suffering in Gaza is an immediate ceasefire, says Michael Fakhri, UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food. But he points out that the US continues to veto resolutions.
When any country vetoes a resolution that is necessary for global peace and security, then the General Assembly has the authority to call for peacekeepers to accompany humanitarian convoys to enter into Gaza, regardless of Israel's position.
He says countries can also implement the arrest warrants that the International Criminal Court has issued for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and former Defense Minister Yoav Gallant. He says they should also place economic and political sanctions on Israel.
The social trauma that it stays with the community lasts for generations. It is one of the most traumatic experiences a people can go through.
Fakhri says the impact of starvation on a population goes beyond the immediate moment. Children who survive, he adds, will likely suffer health complications for the rest of their lives. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
After weeks of tension, Thailand and Cambodia are battling it out over small pieces of contested territory along their shared border. Cambodia launched rockets into Thailand, killing at least 11 civilians, and Thailand sent F-16 fighter jets over the territory to strike Cambodian military targets. This is a serious escalation of a months-long standoff, and it's inflamed nationalist fervor in both countries. The World's Patrick Nguyen is following the story from Bangkok. Patrick, what triggered this confrontation?
Well, Thailand and Cambodia have, for a very long time, been quibbling over their border, especially near areas with ancient temples that both sides claim. And in recent months, the situation has intensified until both sides assembled their armies to basically stare each other down at different parts of the border. And the situation, we've been waiting for it to explode, everybody in Thailand and Cambodia. And today it did, with rockets flying and fighter jets in the air. It's dark here now, but there are reports of Thai forces storming into multiple temples with tanks and infantry to seize them for Thailand once and for all. But we're very much in a fog of war situation here. We don't know exactly what's true and what's not. Even who started it. Both sides blame each other for making the first move. So we're not even clear on that.
So is it clear so far how severe the damage is? And can you tell me anything more about the death toll?
Yeah. Well, here on the Thai side, it's pretty bad. I mean, the Cambodians did a coordinated attack lobbing rockets into several different rural areas in four different provinces. So they hit a gas station with a 7-Eleven. They hit people's houses. They hit a hospital. And here's footage of those rockets filmed by Cambodia's military. And so the targets of those rockets are not Thai army camps necessarily. They also hit places where everyday people live and work. Some of the dead are students, including a 12-year-old girl. So this is really risky stuff on the Cambodian side because it's a smaller country with a smaller military. It does not have fighter jets, and Thailand does. And Thailand sent its F-16s in to blow up military installations and reportedly many tanks as well. So both sides of the border are evacuated. Tens of thousands of people are sleeping outside their homes tonight, and it's a pretty dire situation.
Wow. Tell me more about what exactly they're fighting over. These pieces of land along the border, is that right?
Yeah, I've been to that area quite a few times. You know, it's very beautiful. It's mostly rice fields and water buffalo and not a lot going on. But there are these very small pieces of land, some of which have ancient temples on them, and the uncertainty around who they belong to goes back to this shoddily drawn map drawn by the French Empire in 1907 when Cambodia was a French colony and Thailand was the Kingdom of Siam. So this goes way, way, way back. Cambodia and Thailand have tried to take this to international courts a few times, never walked away with the result that both sides could accept. It's also become very politicized. So when Cambodia wants to puff its chest out, it brings this up. Same with Thailand. Mm-hmm. On Thailand, you have a ruling party that is unstable. It doesn't want to look weak. In Cambodia, you have a one-party state with a newish leader, the son of Cambodia's long-running strongman. He needs to stand up and look strong for himself. So neither side feels it can give up a single inch.
So what is the endgame here? How might this actually be resolved?
Unfortunately, most of the diplomatic options are being exhausted. So Thailand just pulled its ambassador from Cambodia, and Cambodia's ambassador to Thailand is going home too. So there's not much else to do at this point but fight. And almost certainly the death toll that's being reported now is too low. The only hope for mediation right now is Cambodia's government is asking the UN Security Council to convene and stop Thailand's, quote, unprovoked aggression. Thailand is also going to the UN as well to plead its case. So maybe there's a chance for mediation. The odds don't look very good right now, though.
The World's Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok.
On the face of it, Hulk Hogan was an all-American phenomenon.
I'm on that mountaintop, and I'm waiting for you, Andre. And I'm guarding that mountain. And the Hulkster that's guarding has got a 32-inch neck, a 64-inch chest, the largest arms in the world.
Hogan, whose real name was Terry Jean Bollea, died today at 71 in Clearwater, Florida. He dominated the world of professional wrestling in the 1980s, but he was previously big in Japan.
When he arrived in Japan in 1978, he had a built-in backstory there with Japanese-born Hiro Matsuda, who trained Hogan.
Justin Barrasso is the editor-in-chief of Undisputed, an online magazine of all things wrestling and MMA. He says Hogan may be the most recognizable showman ever of professional wrestling. With those massive pythons, his long blonde hair and handlebar mustache, and of course, the voice.
I don't care about those people that aren't star-craven Hulkamaniacs. I could care less what they think. I'm fighting for life, brother. I'm fighting for all those people that have remolded their lives, man. Modeled after Hulkamania.
Endlessly entertaining to his fans, Barrasso says Hulk Hogan was a worldwide phenomenon, even late in life.
2009, so he's well past his prime at that point. He had the Hulkamania Let the Battle Begin tour. And that was the first wrestling appearance of Hogan in Australia. Well, those shows were in Melbourne, in Perth, in Brisbane, in Sydney. And that's a long way from Tokyo. And that's a long way from Madison Square Garden.
Hogan is widely credited for helping to turn professional wrestling from a regional attraction to the mainstream in the 1980s. He was the classic good guy who encouraged kids to eat their vegetables and say their prayers. The Hulkster was pro wrestling champion 6 times.
You're listening to The World, brother. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Electric vehicle sales are on the rise. They jumped 25% last year, but gas, diesel, and jet fuel-powered vehicles will still be around for a long time. So scientists around the world are working on greener alternatives to power them, including a team in Switzerland working on something that's almost science fiction. The world's transportation correspondent, Jeremy Siegel, reports.
Cars connect places. People. Even generations.
Go to the YouTube page of Synhelion, and you'll find videos that look like a Fast and Furious movie combined with a Silicon Valley tech ad. Cars, boats, motorcycles, fueling up and going fast. It all looks like something from another era.
This car is an icon.
In fact, if you watch these videos without sound, you might not even realize they're advertising renewable energy.
But what truly sets it apart is what's inside the tank. It's the world's first car fueled by Synhelion's solar gasoline.
Solar gasoline, or solar fuel, is a bit of a misnomer.
So we use solar heat to drive a thermochemical process.
It's not actually sunlight in a tank, according to Dr. Philip Furler, but a synthetic gas made by combining carbon dioxide and water at super high temperatures generated by solar power.
Typically, we go to around 1,200 degrees, and we operate the chemistry at around 900 degrees Celsius.
Furler is Synhelion's founder and CEO. He says the company uses a field of mirrors to harness power from the sun. That's transferred to a lab where a thermochemical process is used to create the synthetic fuel, which can be used in the same way as traditional fossil fuels. You don't need to reinvent the wheel and build a new zero-emission vehicle. You just need to plop in a different kind of gas at the pump.
They're not just a future hope, they're a present solution.
Camille Mitrelle is an aviation policy expert for Transport and Environment, a Brussels-based organization that advocates for clean energy transportation. She says synthetic fuels like Synhelion's could play an essential role in decarbonizing the aviation sector, especially on long-haul flights.
Because unlike for short routes where battery or hydrogen-powered planes might eventually be a viable solution, long-distance aviation simply cannot wait for those technologies to mature.
Unlike with cars, Mitrelle says, batteries for airplanes, particularly those traveling far, can't store enough energy. If they were big enough to do that, they'd be too heavy to fly. Some governing bodies, like the EU, have set ambitious targets to reduce emissions by incorporating alternatives to traditional jet fuel, like solar. But Mitrelle says that's not enough.
You also need to drive the cost of sustainable aviation fuels down, and that requires subsidies.
Solar fuel is expensive because, unlike with petroleum, the infrastructure doesn't exist yet. So even though it's drop-in ready, solar fuel isn't a viable commercial alternative. Mitrelle says companies like Synhelion need support in order to scale up and make it cheaper.
These fuels exist, and now the ball is definitely in the courts of governments and whether they can provide the right support for these fuels to take off.
Synhelion, for its part, isn't waiting around. Over the past few months, the company has been testing its fuel on all sorts of vehicles and, of course, posting flashy videos of their tests online.
So far, we powered a motorcycle, we powered a steamboat, and we powered a historic race car.
Notably absent from that list for now, an airplane. But fasten your seatbelts, because Furler says more tests are on the way. For The World, I'm Jeremy Siegel.
All eyes have been on a Canadian courtroom today as the public waits for a verdict in a high-profile sexual assault case. Five former NHL players have been on trial for allegedly sexually assaulting a woman back in 2018. Today, the judge delivered her decisions. All five men have been found not guilty. The World's Bianca Hillier has been covering the case. Bianca, what reasoning did the judge give for her verdicts?
Ontario Superior Court Justice Maria Carosia said in court today that she did not find the evidence from the complainant, who's known as EM for privacy reasons, to be credible or reliable. Justice Carosia said EM had a tendency to blame others in her testimony. The judge also took issue with the fact that EM said on the stand that she was telling her truth and not the truth. Another thing, Carolyn, Justice Carosia said consent was at the center of this case, and she found EM to have given consent not impaired by fear. As a reminder, there were two so-called consent videos in this case. They were taken near the end of the alleged assault, and EM says in them that she is, quote, okay with this. The prosecution argued that EM said that because she was scared what would happen if she did not continue with the acts. Justice Carosia said that EM did not display any signs of intoxication in those videos and that she even exaggerated her intoxication during the testimony.
I understand that there was no jury in this trial. The verdicts were entirely up to the judge. Why was that?
Well, the trial started with the jury, but then one of the jurors said that a defense attorney had contacted them outside of the court, so there was a mistrial. Then another jury came in, and some of those jurors thought some of the defense was mocking them. So that jury was dismissed, and it was decided to continue with the judge-alone trial.
So could that have impacted the verdicts?
Lawyers I've spoken with who were not involved in this case say it could have been in the defense's best interest to have a judge-alone trial, because judges have a very clear understanding, of course, of what the law requires for a guilty verdict, whereas a jury needs to be taught that in real time. Judges are often also not as swayed by narrative or emotions heard in court as a jury might be. The prosecution said, though, you know, wait, we presented evidence thinking that this would be a jury making the decision, and they would have taken a different approach if they knew it would be a judge.
Yeah. I know that this has been a very high-profile case in Canada. Bianca, what was the scene at the courthouse today?
Local reports say people started gathering outside the courthouse as early as 6 a.m. Eventually, there were about 100 people out there supporting the complainant, EM. One reporter on the ground counted three people supporting the players, the accused here. And a number of sexual assault support groups have plans to stay out in front of the courthouse tonight.
So is this case expected to have wider repercussions because it has been so high profile?
It is, yes. Jesse Roger, the executive director of a support group called ANOVA, spoke to CTV from outside the courthouse today, saying this could have a chilling effect on survivors.
They rarely report to police. They rarely engage with the legal system because justice is not something that is attainable to them. And watching this happen is just a reaffirmation of that. And so I'm very worried and very sad for EM, but I am terribly worried for the number of victims and survivors who are watching and listening all across the country.
And what about the accused, Bianca? What happens to them?
They're free to go. They've all had professional hockey careers, including in the NHL, but it will be interesting to see if they, you know, find another spot on a team. I do think that this trial will follow these athletes.
The World's Bianca Hillier covers sports for our show. She's been filling us in on the verdicts of five Canadian hockey players on trial for sexual assault. Bianca, thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World.
I'm Tinku Ray, executive editor at The World. Last week's votes in Congress to eliminate federal funding for public media are a devastating blow to communities nationwide. The World is also affected by this defunding. Since our launch in 1996, The World has been an integral part of the public media system, airing on nearly 370 public radio stations across the US and Canada, taking you to places you may never have heard of and bringing you the stories that connect us on this planet. Without federal support, local stations, especially in rural and underserved areas, face deep cuts or even closure. Vital public service alerts, news, storytelling, and programming like The World will be impacted. The world has weathered many storms, and we remain steadfast in our commitment to being your trusted source for human-centered international news, shared with integrity and care. We believe public media is about truth and access for all. As an independent, non-profit newsroom, we aren't controlled by billionaire owners or corporations. We are sustained by listeners like you. Now, more than ever, we need your help to support our global reporting work and power the future of the world. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. On behalf of the entire team here at The World, thank you. You make our work possible.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Anti-Semitism is not new. Unfortunately, this form of prejudice and hatred has been around for a long time. Right now, though, there are heated debates about what anti-Semitism is and how it relates to criticism of Israel. Those debates are happening worldwide, given the current war and humanitarian crisis in Gaza. Interrogating the concept of anti-Semitism, though, is not only difficult, but for many Jews, painful and scary. Peter Beinart has his perspective, which we're going to hear now. He's a longtime thinker and commentator on all things Israel and the author of the recent book, Being Jewish After the Destruction of Gaza. And he's among those who does make a distinction between anti-Semitism versus being anti-Israel or anti-Zionist.
I think it's critical to be able to make a distinction between bigotry against a group of people and criticism or condemnation of a state, right? That people might have very legitimate criticisms of the People's Republic of China. It doesn't mean that they're bigoted towards Chinese people, or if they have serious criticisms of Saudi Arabia or Pakistan, doesn't mean that they're anti-Muslim. Even if you say that you think the ideology of the state of China or the ideology of the state of Iran or Saudi Arabia is immoral, and you don't believe that China should be run by the Communist Party, even that does not make you necessarily an anti-Chinese bigot, which is why I think that it is not only not anti-Semitic to criticize Israeli policies, it's not inherently anti-Semitic to question the legitimacy of a Jewish state. If you believe in the principle of equality under the law, that states should not favor one religious or ethnic or racial group over another, it's not bigoted to say that you believe that principle of equality under the law should apply to Israeli Jews and Palestinians, just as you want it to apply in the United States.
I mean, there are people, though, who say that because Israel is a Jewish state, anti-Semitism is also an attack on the state of Israel.
There are, but and this argument has, we hear it so often that it has a certain superficial plausibility. But would someone say that it is, if you're a constant critic of human rights abuses in Nigeria or Zambia or Kenya, that you're anti-Black? All states, regardless of their racial, religious, ethnic composition, are fair game for criticism. And the ideologies of those states, the political systems of those states, are fair game for criticism. Now, again, the criticism may be well-founded or not well-founded, but it's not inherently bigoted unless you can show that it is emanating from a hostility to Jews as Jews.
And we should say, Peter, that this is a conversation a lot of people are afraid of having. What are some of the ways it can go wrong and why?
I think, unfortunately, a lot of people are afraid to enter into this debate. They're afraid to speak out in what they're when they see concerns about what Israel is doing to Palestinians, because so often those critics are indeed called anti-Semitic, and people don't want to be called anti-Semitic. It's a terrible thing to be accused of, given the horrors that have been done by anti-Semites historically.
So conversations among Jews about what is and isn't anti-Semitic are intensifying. How do you see what's happening now in Gaza in particular, but also with Israel's military campaigns throughout the region more broadly, leading to those intense conversations?
There is a very, very deep divide among American Jews, particularly along generational lines, in which many younger American Jews are really appalled by how Israel treats Palestinians, and particularly what Israel has done in Gaza. And they have even more basic questions about the nature of the state. The irony is that American Jews have been raised to believe that our safety depends on the principle of equality under the law. That's what we believe in America, most of us. And yet we're also supposed to believe that we need to support a state in Israel which is based on a principle of Jewish supremacy, a principle in which Jews have superior legal rights to Palestinians. Most of the Palestinians under Israeli control can't even become citizens of the state in which they live. And so more younger American Jews are facing that contradiction and asking questions about the nature of a Jewish state. And that's very upsetting to many older American Jews and many more, you know, conservative political Jews. But it's not anti-Semitic. It is a deep ideological divide that has opened up among American Jews.
So right after October 7th, 2023, I watched in real time as a family email collapsed into hurt feelings. It was also clearly generational, as you just said. And yet I saw recently videos of a few hundred Israelis of various ages marching against the starvation faced by many in Gaza right now. Who are they speaking for in Israel these days?
The numbers of Israelis who are Jews who are upset about what Israel is doing to Palestinian Gaza is growing, but it is still a minority of Israeli Jews. Most Israeli Jews who oppose the war are doing so not because primarily they're concerned about what's happening to Palestinians. They simply want the hostages to come back, and they don't want their brothers and sons to have to continue to fight in the war. It's been very difficult in Israel since October 7th to speak out about Palestinian rights and about Palestinian humanity, which makes me even more admiring of those people who do.
I'm speaking with author and commentator Peter Beinart about the meanings of anti-Semitism today. So anti-Semitism is on the rise, and as the war on Gaza continues, so is anti-Israel sentiment. For many Jews, Israel, as a concept, if not a reality, represents a refuge from persecution and violence, while others say Israel, given its militarism, is the least safe place on earth for Jews. How does that affect the debate over whether it's okay to criticize Israel?
I think that, to be fair, most people, I think, do think it's legitimate to criticize Israel. The real debate has to do with whether it's legitimate to question the idea of a Jewish state itself, the idea of political Zionism, the idea of a state that's based on legal favoritism of Jews over Palestinians. That's where the real divide is. And I think that, you know, for many Jews, the idea of a Jewish state is, as you say, this sense, the thing that makes that is a kind of ultimate refuge for them, and that they believe it's what keeps Israeli Jews safe. And for them, a world without a Jewish state would be a world in which Israeli Jews were radically unsafe, and even Jews around the world were radically unsafe. I disagree. I actually think that Israeli Jews are made less safe by this system of legal supremacy, because when you deny people basic rights, you inflict terrible violence on them, the violence of oppression, and that violence makes everybody less safe. I think that the reason that American Jews and British and Australian Jews are safer than Jews in Israel is precisely because we live in states that are not based on legal supremacy, because equality under the law actually allows for politics that are less violent than systems of oppression.
So we're seeing now the rise of anti-Semitic movements, fringe groups and violent actors staging attacks on Jews, the killing of two young employees at the Israeli embassy in Washington, the rise of neo-Nazi groups in Germany and other parts of Europe. What is the connection to the larger debate and what's happening with Israel?
On the right, what we're seeing is that anti-Semitism is rising in tandem with other forms of bigotry, anti-Islamophobia, anti-immigrant, anti-Black, anti-LGBT. And these bigotries do generally travel together. These are people who basically want these countries to be homogenous and hierarchical, and they want their group to be on top, and everybody who's not like them, they want to be on bottom. On the left, what we're seeing, including among these terrible, terrible incidents of people who were killed because they were at pro-Israel events, is a failure to recognize that it is illegitimate to take out your hostility against Israel on Jews. It's also illegitimate to take out your anger against Israel in violent ways, even against people who are clearly supportive of Israel. Violence is illegitimate in a political conversation and action in the United States, period. And Jews are not responsible for what Israel does any more than Chinese people are responsible, Chinese Americans are responsible for what Beijing does. But the Jewish organizations have to make that distinction as well. And part of the problem is that establishment American Jewish organizations constantly conflate being Jewish with being a supporter of Israel.
So as long as there are people who believe that any form of anti-Semitism is an attack on Israel, will that simply serve the current government of Netanyahu as its kind of perennial casus belli?
Yes. And in fact, Netanyahu has a long history of being strongly allied with some of the most anti-Semitic leaders in the world, right? I mean, Viktor Orban, for instance, in Hungary, who's been very blatantly anti-Semitic in the way he talks about George Soros, is probably Netanyahu's biggest defender in Europe. And people find that hard to believe, but it's not actually a contradiction. There's a long history of anti-Semites supporting Zionism and supporting Israel, because after all, if you don't like the Jews in your country and you don't wish they were not there, it's very attractive to think that they might all go to a country of their own.
You host weekly conversations on Zoom for paid subscribers of your Substack, The Binary Notebook. You've convened diverse voices to really wrestle with this stuff. You've also just come off of an international book tour for your book. What are some of the things people are bringing up in those conversations?
Again and again, I hear from people who are estranged from their families, from their communities, from their rabbis, and who are in immense pain about what's happening. Many of the people who I talk to are people who just simply can't believe that the people they love, the people they look to often as religious and communal leaders, are not speaking out in the face of what is the mass slaughter and starvation of an entire people. There are more child amputees in Gaza than any place on earth, even though there are only 2 million people. There's an estimate now by an academic at University of London that 4% of the population of Gaza has been killed since October 7th, which is the largest percentage of any population that has been killed in a military conflict in the 21st century. And so the people I talk to are often saying, how can it be that people who speak in our name as Jews, when we were raised to believe that Judaism is about the idea of seeing that all human beings are created in the image of God, how can it be that our leaders are silent or even supportive of this?
Peter, where are the conversations happening that can move this whole debate forward?
It's among young people. There is a tremendous, I would say, kind of moral uprising and spiritual uprising that is happening among young American Jews who feel betrayed by their communal establishment and their leaders and their institutions, and they are creating new institutions, and it's going to transform American Jewish life. There are so many minyanim, Jewish prayer communities, that have emerged for young people in New York City alone, just in the last couple of years, of people who want to live committed, serious, meaningful, engaged Jewish lives, but not have to check their ethics at the door. And it's those kids who give me hope.
Anti-Semitism, I mean, have we been talking about a term that has been historically adulterated? And could it just lose any meaning whatsoever?
I think one of the great fears is that there's so much bad faith use of claims of anti-Semitism to try to shut down legitimate questions about Israel and Zionism, that it produces a cynicism about the entire conversation that is extremely dangerous. It makes me very angry, to be honest, to see Jewish leaders who simply don't have any good arguments to defend the starvation and slaughter and oppression of an entire people. And because they don't have any good arguments, they rely on this legacy of the suffering and oppression of previous generations of Jews. And they take this legacy, which we should keep with great care, a kind of sacred inheritance, and they use it in the most promiscuous ways in order to try to intimidate and slander good people who are simply outraged because they can't bear to see another Palestinian child being murdered or starved to death. It's a disgrace. And I worry that we'll make it harder to tackle the very real problem of anti-Semitism, because as liberal democracy fails, anti-Semitism, like Islamophobia, anti-Black racism, anti-trans, anti-LGBT, it is rising, particularly on the right, and we need to take it seriously in fighting it, but this is doing the opposite.
We've been talking about anti-Semitism and what it means with Peter Beinart. He's just completed a tour supporting his most recent book, Being Jewish After the Destruction of Gaza.
Imagine growing up in the U.S., going to high school, starting a career, having a family, only to learn that you're not actually an American citizen. That's exactly what happened to thousands of children born in other countries and adopted by American parents in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. From KPBS in San Diego, Gustavo Solis reports.
Shirley Chung was adopted from South Korea in 1966 and raised in Texas. You can still hear it when she talks.
Grew up in a Black household, went to white private schools, went to Black churches with my parents, went to white churches with my friends I went to school with.
Chung assumed she was an American citizen most of her life, until she misplaced her Social Security card about 5 years ago and tried to get a new one. She was 57 at the time.
So when I went to the Social Security office, that's when they told me, we can't give you your card, you need to prove your status in this country. I didn't know what that meant.
It meant that she wasn't actually a U.S. citizen.
I think I was more hurt than anything because it started triggering all those feelings of you don't belong, you're not white enough, you're not Black enough, you're not Korean enough, now you're not American enough.
Chung is just one of between 30 and 70,000 international adoptees who never became U.S. citizens. Emily Howe is a lawyer trying to help these people adjust their immigration status.
There were individuals who were babies, you know, 2 months old, 5 months old, like 18 months old, who were shipped overseas through no choice of their own. And now that they're in their 40s, 50s, and 60s, it should not be their problem.
This work is personal for Howe. She was born in Vietnam and adopted by American parents. Now, she became a U.S. citizen when she was still a child. The process worked for her, but she cannot imagine what it's like for adoptees who never got that opportunity.
The issue of the undocumented adoptees is so egregious and appalling. It's just such a fundamental issue of basic human rights that I had figured if and when I can do anything about it, I should.
Howe says that our outdated immigration laws don't offer an easy fix for this administrative problem. There's no form that adoptees can fill out or an appeal that they can file. Instead, immigration lawyers have to find workarounds to establish citizenship, either through marriage or children or some kind of humanitarian visa program. And that lack of an easy fix is incredibly frustrating for Chung, who says that her friends are often surprised to learn about her immigration status.
You know, part of their response was, well, why don't you just go and apply for citizenship? And I just want to kind of knock their teeth down their throat, because I'm a very intelligent woman standing in front of you. If you thought it was that easy, don't you think I would have done it?
Instead of actually knocking teeth in, Chung has channeled that energy to advocacy work through the organization Adoptee Rights Campaign. Joy Alessi is the executive director.
After families went through the adoption process, it's pretty lengthy. It was even back then. They get through court, they get their adoption finalized, and they're very, very focused on the child and the family unit and so on. And oftentimes they just didn't either know that they were supposed to do that last filing for the citizenship, or sometimes they just forgot.
Alessi says there are impacted adoptees from all over the world, but those from South Korea are overrepresented. That's because after the Korean War, the U.S. and South Korean governments encouraged adoption between the two countries. More recently, the South Korean government's Truth and Reconciliation Commission found instances of fraud in the adoption system at that time. Alessi is one of those South Korean adoptees. She says Americans broadly support fixing the problem.
They understand that there is a difference here. And most of them are very, very sympathetic and willing to even advocate. But Congress is another beast.
The Adoptee Rights Campaign has spent the last 10 years asking Congress to pass the Adoptee Citizenship Act. The legislation would grant citizenship to adoptees who never formalized their status. Lawmakers considered the bill in 2022, but never passed it. Chung will continue to advocate for adoptees, who are now especially afraid of deportation because of President Donald Trump's aggressive immigration enforcement.
I don't know what's going to happen.
Yes.
You know, is it going to take some of us to start getting picked up for us to get our story out there? I hope not.
Chung plans to continue carrying on as an American, even if it's taking time for the paperwork to catch up. For The World, I'm Gustavo Solis, San Diego.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The streets of London are teeming with spies, not in a James Bond film or an episode of Slow Horses, but in real life, according to new reporting in Politico. The United Kingdom is the global hub for private intelligence firms, which often hire former spies and intelligence analysts, and they operate with barely any regulation. Mason Boycott Owen reported on this subject for Politico. He told us that private intelligence is a giant umbrella term that covers all kinds of different activities.
The main bit that it covers is working for quite big clients, kind of your financial firms or your legal firms, all the way down to kind of the slightly more murky end of the thing, which is involving a lot of what you call the private investigators. And the work that some of those companies do ranges from ethically questionable in quite a grey area, things like surveillance, all the way down to some of the slightly more dodgy practices, which can be illegal, such as hacking or theft.
So who are these private intelligence companies working for? Who's hiring them?
there's a broad range of clients. The main pool where they get most of their money from in the UK is from kind of big money business. So it'd be your hedge funds, your equity organizations, banks, places that are involved in very high stakes legal battles. But there are other areas of work that they can get. And the slightly more frowned upon aspect comes from overseas.
So working for foreign governments?
Foreign governments is a part of it, but it is a smaller part of it compared to working for people that are aligned with foreign governments. So
okay.
Russia, for example, you will have a vast number of businessmen, oligarchs. Those would, you know, be an overseas entity that may or may not be aligned with a foreign government.
I want to understand a little bit better what this looks like on the ground from the perspective of targets of these companies. You talked to some of them. I'm wondering if you can pick one and tell me sort of through their eyes what happened to them when they started being surveilled and other things.
In terms of the people that I spoke to, obviously we spoke to them under the condition of anonymity because, you know, these companies are incredibly powerful. They have a very wide reach. But to pick out one example, they said that they were, you know, target of surveillance where private intelligence companies and the people that they hired were able to film them inside his house, obtain confidential information by misrepresenting them to their bank, and also paid someone to access their phones.
Are there regulations around this type of work in the UK? And would it even matter if there were, if these companies are willingly doing illegal things?
So the regulation basically falls into two categories. The first is the kind of like high-level stuff for foreign states. That's basically covered by national security legislation. On the slightly lower level, you've got this kind of domestic work that they're doing, you know, the works for banks, the works for legal firms. This work has a habit of falling between the gaps in legislation. And Britain does have a bit of a perception problem that the regulatory bodies for a lot of organisations in the UK don't quite have the teeth to impose fines or escalate cases of bad practice.
You've touched on this a bit, but I'm curious if you can say more about why the UK and London in particular is such a hub for private intelligence companies.
Britain is very good at spying. It's got a very good international record for intelligence work. This has made its way into the public consciousness with, you know, novels of John le Carré and obviously the James Bond films. You know, it may seem a bit silly that this might be why people would want to set up a business in a country just because it's on, you know, TV and stuff. But, you know, people really do revel, particularly the people that work in this industry, really do revel in, you know, the secrecy and the intrigue of all of that. The slightly more dull point is that Britain has a very good time zone for working internationally, but also the, you know, the biggest client base, those city firms, hedge funds, banks, they're all centered in London.
So I'm guessing spying looks a lot different than it did, say, 50 years ago. Do changes in technology play into how private intelligence companies in the UK work?
Yeah, absolutely. I think intelligence is, you know, mirroring all of society and the fact that so much of it is online, so much of it is using the digital sphere, targeting of information online, such as, you know, internet traffic, phone calls. And it doesn't seem to be a industry that has any sign of completely disappearing. It's, you know, it still is big business.
Mason Boycott Owens is a reporter at Politico who looked at the private intelligence industry.
We leave you today on a hopeful note that years after the destruction of war, beautiful things can flourish. When the Vietnam War ended half a century ago this year, the new Vietnam, under its socialist leaders from the North, initially banned pop music, known as Nhạc Vàng, or golden music, because of its perceived Western aesthetic. It was replaced by Nhạc Đỏ, or red music, espousing the new revolutionary path the country was on.
Trường Sơn Đông, Trường Sơn Tây, bên nắng đốt, bên mưa quay.
Videos of Nhạc Đỏ, the red music, are still popular on YouTube, judging from the number of views of this video featuring women singers in battle fatigues. But since 2016, the pre-1975 sounds of Vietnam have been getting renewed exposure, thanks in large part to this band, Saigon Soul Revival.
Thoáng thấy hình bóng người đẹp của anh.
form of this tune is a 12-bar minor key blues, about as Western as you can get. Things do change, evidently, and they can sound great. Saigon Soul Revival are based in Ho Chi Minh City. Their reason for being is all about revisiting the pop music that South Vietnamese artists were making before the end of the war. Saigon Soul Revival start with that palette and then bring in new sounds that morph the old with the new. They record in Vietnam and have started touring internationally in the past 2 years. If you happen to be in Germany or Denmark next month, they'll be playing a few dates there. Saigon Soul Revival take us out today with a rocking track that got them a lot of attention. This was featured in the Netflix adaptation of the best-selling novel by writer Viet Thanh Nguyen, The Sympathizer.
Comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Online at theworld.org and on YouTube, find us at The World News GBH, all one word. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for making it today. Have a great evening, and we'll see you right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Mary Elizabeth Alexander, Nicole and David Berger, Dan Shee and Ted McGovern, Anne and John Newman, and Lawrence Wilkinson. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.